Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Founders Club Radio.
Welcome to the Founders Club, where each week we talk to the founders and leaders of great private companies. I'm your host, John Coffin, and today we're joined in the studio by Matt Devine, the CEO of DHM Adhesives, and Will Underwood, the founder and president of Ironwood Insurance. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, John.
Good morning, John.
Matt, thanks for coming down from Greenville today. We really appreciate it. I wanted to just have you start, if you would, and tell us a little bit about DHM Adhesives.
DHM Adhesives, we've been in business. We're celebrating our 30th year this year. We started in 1984 in Norcross, Georgia. We now reside and have a plant in Calhoun, Georgia. We are approximately a $35 million in sales company, and our specialty is manufacturing hot melt adhesives for end users and actually other glue companies.
Okay, so hot melt adhesives. Tell me a little bit about that. What are some of your end users that might use that?
The different factions that participate with our packaging. We also do converting. It could be a mattress application, furniture, automotive. Believe it or not, there's 35 pounds of glue in the average car today.
Really? Now, how does that happen?
It's in the headliners. It's in the carpet. A lot of different places.
Just all over the place.
All over the place.
And now, this is the second generation company. Your father started the company. Tell us about that.
My dad was a chemist with DuPont, one of many that assisted the original scientist that invented EVA technology, which is our specialty. There's several different kinds of hot melts. One of them is EVA.
And what does that stand for?
Ethylene vinyl acetate.
Okay, that sounds really scary. But
yeah, if you're not a chemical
engineer. Is that a bunch of chemical?
Yeah, it's a bunch of chemical stuff. It's all safe. You can eat it, John.
Okay.
My dad used to eat it all the time. I wouldn't recommend it, but he started with DuPont in 1958 and actually worked with the scientists and invented the original technology. And after starting a bunch of glue companies for other people, at 55 years old, he pulled a Colonel Sanders and started his own
okay.
in 1983. But 84 is when DHM Adhesives was incorporated.
And so you started in Norcross. I guess that's where he was living at the time?
I thought he'd lost his mind. No, he always lived in Simpsonville, South Carolina. But he had a partner from Weyerhaeuser Corporation, another partner from H.P. Fuller. And my dad had been with several adhesive companies, including National Adhesives, DuPont, Celanese. And the three of them got together and started the company.
Okay. So when did you make the decision to go into the family business, so to speak?
Actually, we were playing golf together, and I told him that, you know, I was thinking about making a change. And he said, well, you need to come talk to us. And I said, what for? And he said, well, we could use a good salesman. And it was probably 2 or 3 weeks later, I went to talk to him, and he said, you know, we'd love to have you. Why don't you put down some salary requirements? And so I put him down, and he never called me back. So after about a month, being the efficient salesman that I've tried to be and continue to be, I hope, I said, you know, what's the problem? And his answer was, I wasn't comfortable with that. And I found out later on in life after working with him, when he wasn't comfortable, it meant no and, you know, heck no. So
okay,
that's how it happened.
So. Then he got comfortable, or did you cave in?
I caved in.
Okay.
But he made me a promise, John, and this is kind of when I've always wanted to be an entrepreneur. I think I had it, you know, my first job was paper route. My next real job was painting someone's house at 13 years old because I borrowed the car to go to a tennis match instead of the paper route and put a couple creases in the door. So my dad said I was going to paint the family house that summer, and that resulted in me becoming a painter. So I always ran my own company, and I put myself through college running a janitorial service.
So this was kind of really an opportunity for you to, scratch that entrepreneurial itch to a certain extent.
And he made me a promise that if I treated it as my own, that I would never go back to work for somebody else again. And he was right. And it was a huge cut in pay. I was with a great company, and I took him at his word, and he treated me as a partner for years.
So you took over the business as the 100% owner back, I guess, in 2004, right?
2004. The original plan, my father and I were going to buy out, or I was going to buy out his silent partner and become my father's real partner instead of just his pseudo partner, which is the way he treated me. And unfortunately, my father got sick in that time frame, so the original banking relationship that we did, I had to take out both parties. So in 2004, I closed on the business, and I was the 100% owner.
So since then, I mean, the sales growth has been incredible, 10 times sales growth. If I calculate it, it's 27% compound annual growth. That's just incredible. What's really been the driver for your sustained growth, Matt?
Well, it's called debt and fear. I've always I had a boss tell me a long time ago, people do things for two reasons, fear or greed. And it wasn't greed because I've never been a greedy person, but I was afraid to fail. So it was, I had a legacy to take on from my father. Mm-hmm. You know, he was the chemist, and so there was a lot of pressure there. But how we achieved the growth, growing up in life, for some reason, I always took after my uncle, who ended up being assistant to the president at Gillette. And my mom followed his career, and she told me that if you're ever in your own business, surround yourself with people smarter than yourself. And that's pretty easy to do in my case. So that's what I did. So that's the first thing. The second reason we've been able to grow so fast, because we've gone from 3.2 million to almost sometime this year, early next year, we'll be at the 40 million annualized rate, is we give away 10% of our earnings to charity every year.
Really?
Okay. Yes, sir.
And is that specific charities that you're interested in, or do you open it up to your employees as well to help decide?
We open it up to the employees. It's charities that I'm interested in. The primary charity that we support is Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation.
Okay.
I don't have an individual connection to that, which is unusual in that community, but I was asked to help raise money, and I did, and we really feel that disease can be eradicated in our lifetime. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, my wife and I are the honorees of this year's gala in Greenville, South Carolina.
Congratulations. That's an incredible commitment to a great cause. One of the things that I know is kind of an issue for a lot of U.S. manufacturers is the green initiative that's going on. And you guys have really been on the forefront of that. Can you describe some of your activity on that front?
We don't throw away anything. you can when a batch, you know, it's a batch process in our particular glue. Now you can make it continuously, but if there's an issue, we can rework it, so to speak.
Okay.
So we don't throw anything away, and we recycle everything that comes out of the plant, and our products are all recyclable.
So, how do you come up with new products? I imagine, you know, you mentioned that you're not a traditional chemist, but I know that you have people on staff who do a lot of that. Talk about your R&D process and some of the revolutionary things you guys are coming up with.
Well, we're in the heart of the carpet capital of the world, and they are looking to replace some backings to get cheaper applications. They used to say that energy was about a penny a foot on carpet. Now, carpet's been down with the downturn in housing, but with the energy prices now, that's 4 cents a foot.
Wow.
So they're looking for different ways to use, you know, glue on carpet. So hot melts become a big part of that, because, you know, once you put it down at a temperature, and then it cools. It doesn't require any drying like typical carpet does. But really, we're customer-driven. Our customers are asking us for needs, and we're providing them, hopefully, in most cases.
And you're really – you mentioned packaging carpets. You're really addressing the needs of lots of different industry segments. It's just, they have different applications kind of across the board. So very broad business with a diversified group of clients.
Yes, absolutely.
So tell me a recent new client win that you're particularly proud of.
A recent new client win, probably, it's not exactly recent, but it's this year, and it's in the artificial turf business. And in artificial turf, if anybody watches NFL football or college football,
nobody watches anything.
When the ball hits the field, you see that little stuff come up. That's crumpled rubber.
Okay.
And typically, the way that the grass is adhered to the substrate to hold it down, they've been using a urethane, which is not friendly to the environment. And we do that with hot melts. That would be a big recent development in our company.
Fantastic. So you're providing the playing field for all of our passions. That's really great.
Yes.
One other thing. I know that having visited your plant, it's a very impressive building up in Calhoun. Is there, as we kind of come out of the downturn, a lot of companies, manufacturers, distribution companies, et cetera, are starting to think about making major capital expenditures in order to grow and upgrade their facilities. Talk about how you go through that CapEx process and assessment and, how you make kind of critical capital expenditure decisions in your company.
We've already done a couple. We were getting... you've been there, so you know we're a little bit landlocked in our facility. So a couple of years ago, one thing we did is we moved down the street to a distribution center. So as product comes out of our place and it passes through quality, then we immediately ship it to distribution. We can service, I think, 8 truckloads at the same time, where we only had 3 dock doors at the current facility.
Okay.
But how we go through the CapEx program, I'd like it to be returned in 12 months. But more importantly, our capacity has to stay ahead of our growth plans. And our growth plan, we've put it in the numbers, and we've talked to, the people that are involved with our business. Our growth, our next goal is $100 million.
So you've prospectively not only need to think about new equipment and machinery in your existing plant, but potentially another site, or do you have capacity in your current location?
Our capacity in our current location is somewhere around 60 to 65 million.
Okay.
So we got plenty of room to grow if anybody's interested, but we are actively considering a second site as we speak, and we're looking to bring manufacturing back from actually 2 different places in the world, one Asia and the other the Caribbean. So we'll bring both equipment and business back to the U.S.
So not manufacturing that you control currently, but
that's correct.
But bringing that back, that's been a huge trend recently. Is companies just deciding, the on the water time is way too much of a hassle for me to focus on something coming back from China or whatever. So you've really seen a huge trend in that bringing business back to America. It sounds like.
Yes, and possibly the driving factor is shale gas versus mm-hmm. oil, mm-hmm. and that's a big deal. You're going to see a resurgence in the chemical industry that hasn't been seen since the 1950s or 60s in the United States over the next even 20 to 30 years.
Just because of the cost of energy.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
I mean, oil, if you've seen oil, I think today it's $80, maybe even $75. That was a high of $135 several years ago. With the unrest in the Middle East, you would assume it'd be back to the $135. But the difference is with the shale gas, natural gas is $4, and it's just a much more effective way to make ethylene and eventually polyethylene and different compounds.
Thanks, Matt. This has been it's so great to hear about American manufacturing company having so much success, and American made, American owned. It's something to be really proud of. Thank you. Will, welcome. Great to see you. Please describe for our listeners Ironwood Insurance and what you guys are up to.
Okay. Well, John, thanks for having me here today. unlike Matt, our business is only 7 years old. We founded it in 2007, or I should say I founded it in 2007. It was a result of being part of a great company that was sold to a large public bank, and that was in 2005. And a small group of us decided that we didn't want to be part of that, part of the bank. And so in May of 2007, struck out on our own and formed Ironwood. We're a commercial. We have 3 products. We're a commercial insurance broker. We provide employee benefits consulting and payroll and HR services to middle market companies really around the world.
Okay, and so this genesis of the business was really thinking that you could do better on your own. Talk about that very early stage when you decided to strike out. You know, what was the driving force of that for you? And probably a pretty big risk at the time, I would think.
Well, like so many businesses that start like ours, I think that there was some pain involved. I was a producer at a firm, and I was an owner, a small owner, but I was a part of a great company, and I loved it there. And I'd probably still be there today had that sale not occurred. It wasn't necessarily the wrong place to be. It was just the wrong place to be for me. It was just a different way of approaching the business that I wasn't used to. I never really viewed myself as an entrepreneur, although I never had a salary. I was always a commission. Our business is run by salespeople on commission. But I never really viewed myself as an entrepreneur. I think that this move was a I think we saw opportunity. There was pain, and then there was opportunity. We set out to recreate a business and improve upon a business model that had been followed by some other great firms. I would characterize them as being, from a customer standpoint, big broker capabilities with Main Street service.
Okay, so that's kind of that's the core issue. One of the things that you mentioned is that ownership element, and it sounds like you have pretty widely distributed ownership to your partners in the business. Talk about that in a very sales driven culture. How important that is, and what the benefits have been to Ironwood of your decision really to share the wealth, so to speak.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably the main differentiator for our firm when it comes to attracting industry talent. And that's really what it's all about in our business. The assets are the people. We don't have any machines. We don't have any, a product that we sell. We sell a promise. So we treat our assets as the people. And in order to attract the best people out there, you want an empowerment type model. And along with that comes an equity component in the business. And so our goal is to dilute ourselves. We want dilution. We want to have more owners. They don't necessarily have to be producers in our firm. They can be, not a producer is someone that creates revenue for our firm, but they can be, people that service the business once it comes in the door as well. So we right now have about 25% of our employees are owners of the firm. Our goal is to continue to broaden that and attract people with the same sort of the same sort of business model.
That ownership mentality is incredibly powerful. It really gets everyone, whether you're on the origination side of things or the client service side of things, rowing in the same direction, which is incredible.
Yeah, it really is.
You talked a little bit about the promise. Talk about what you view are the unique differentiators of Ironwood versus other providers. This is, I guess, like banking, a bit of a commoditized type of industry with a lot of people doing it. How do you guys differentiate yourself in the market?
Yeah, as I said before, I think we try to position ourselves where we have big broker capabilities, meaning deep resources to bring to more sophisticated buyers of middle market insurance products. So we have high end claims people. We have people that have D&O expertise. We have environmental expertise within our firm. But then we try to provide what I call the Main Street service model. So many of our large competitors have more of a institutional service model.
Mm-hmm.
Ours is more customized and very reactive and responsive. And so we try to position ourselves in the middle somewhere there where you can get what we think is the best of both worlds. But I would say the main differentiators are really when you attract the best people, you provide the best services and products to others. And so we really look at the people we're attracting into the industry, into our business, and the differentiate, as opposed to our competition, and the key differentiators are we're a long-term play, so we're not for sale. Our business is right now in particular, there's a lot of businesses out there looking to acquire insurance firms, and they're paying You know, very high multiples, historically high multiples. But, you know, if you're a 30-year-old producer at Ironwood or any broker, do you really want to be to have the uncertainty of being sold again and sold again and sold again? And so we promise longevity and we promise equity. And I'd say those are our key differentiators. You know, like Matt, we have a foundation. We created a foundation day one, and we give 1% of our revenues away. So it probably equates somewhat to, you know, what DHM is doing. But we feel like that's a it's the right thing to do. It's not the reason we do it is not for business, but it attracts a certain kind of person to our firm that has a certain heart.
So, what an incredible model that both of you have. Are there specific charities or organizations that you guys are supporting on a regular basis?
There are quite a few. You know, we support Trinity House, if you're familiar with a local transitional home for homeless men with drug and alcohol dependency. That's a big one for us. Breakthrough Atlanta.
Okay.
You know, I love children's health care. I mean, they raise a ton of money and they don't really need a lot, but they're, you know, they just do great work in this community. And we have some other ones that are, you know, not quite as heart driven, but more interest driven, like conservation and environmental causes as well.
Right. What an incredible story that both of you have committed really from the front end of starting your company to giving back. And, you know, I just make a comment here. I think that really that's true in almost all of the companies that we talk to on Founders Club. Is it's just a remarkable giving spirit that that entrepreneurs have because they're key to the community. So insurance for a lot of people, Will, is kind of one of those things that they think about maybe annually, but could you give us a current market update on some trends in both the PNC industry as well as the employee benefits side of things? What are you seeing out there?
Well, I'm a PNC commercial broker by background, so I'm not as
PNC
capable.
Stands for property and
property
casualty.
Property and casualty, okay. Correct. And so in our industry, or in our side of the business, rates have been fairly stable for quite some time now. I think even in decline, rates are the rate environment's impacted by a lot of different things that are outside of a buyer's control. But the stuff that's in their control is claims, safety, those types of things. But there's things, just the rate environment can swing up and down with just general capacity for insurance companies to underwrite business. So in our side, I'd say we've been in a declining or very stable marketplace for many years.
Okay.
And so CFOs and insurance buyers that have, a lot of our clients or have a lot of other things to do, things to worry about. And so, it's been what I would call stable. You know, on the healthcare side, of course, that's a totally different story. I mean, it's a big topic of conversation, and people in our industry are having to, work a lot harder to advise our customers with Obamacare and how to respond to that and react to that, how to, buy their products the most efficiently. There's just so much uncertainty on that side that there's a ton of interest in. You get three people at our, when we do a seminar, you get three people at the commercial seminar and you get, 50 people at the benefits seminar.
Right. Yeah. It's and so you're really dealing with carriers across the board. You're somewhat agnostic as to who you deal with, I would imagine.
We're an independent broker. Mm-hmm. And we although we do contract with insurance companies, that's the way it works. We consider ourselves to be a broker, which is we're representing our customers, and we're trying to find them the best products and services based on their own buying appetites.
So you mentioned the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. I guess a big element of that for employee benefits is the introduction of pretty aggressive wellness programs. And talk a little bit about that, the trends there, and what you're seeing on wellness and what all business owners should be expecting on that front.
Yeah, well, we have a great wellness coordinator in our office named Tricia Brown, and she's fantastic, and she's implemented a wellness program in our office.
And so, are you on the treadmill like every morning because of it?
Well, I'm one of the. I'm one of the stragglers. I'm one of the problem children. I think
you got to get on the program, man.
I'm trying to get with it. I'm trying to get with it, but I think employers are you know desperately seeking ways to lower their cost in the healthcare arena. It's an ever increasing cost, one of the best ways to tackle that is take matters into your own hands and try to help your employees get healthier. It's the right thing to do,
right?
But it's also a money saver. And yep. So if you can implement these programs and help your educate your, a big part of it is education.
So it seems like the way that a lot of the carriers are structuring these, there's just this natural increase that's going to happen just almost by the force of the weight of the healthcare industry. And wellness seems to be one of the key elements of how you can kind of bring that down or blunt the increase.
Am I understanding that correctly?
I mean,
if you have healthier employers, you have lower healthcare cost. I don't know what the percentage is, but everybody knows that a very large portion of our healthcare dollars are lifestyle related, mm-hmm. right? Things that happen to people as a result of their choices they make. In a lot of cases, certainly not all, but helping them get educated to eat better, exercise, quit smoking, those kind of things it's a good thing for society, and it's a hopefully lowers your cost. And people that don't play, you can actually allocate a little bit more of the cost to them that don't participate in your program. So it's a big initiative in our industry.
It's remarkable the power of data these days. You hear a lot about big data and data analytics. Well, I know that's probably something that affects the insurance industry pretty significantly. Could you talk about that and how you're at the brokerage level seeing that come into play?
Yeah, I mean, data analytics, it's kind of a big word now that you hear a lot. And I think it's something that a lot of brokers and a lot of people in our industry, both on the commercial side, and the healthcare side, have been doing for a long time. We just didn't call it that.
Mm-hmm.
But you're using claim data, essentially, for us to look at trends, to, find different root causes of accidents. And by managing the data at a sort of a macro level, then you have a chance to you can look at trends and you can sort of identify where to focus your attention.
Right.
And again, in the name of cost reduction. So using data just to, figure out where to focus your efforts.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about it, but I guess your business really was probably one of the start of the data movement, because that's really has been driving claims pricing, et cetera, for a long, long time.
Right. I mean, your claims data is the key driver to your cost. It's a
interesting. Matt, what about technology in your business? How's it really changed your business over the years?
probably primarily it would be inventory control.
Okay.
Our sales guys have their goals. They go after their goals, and we follow those and track those. But you don't need a computer to do that. We obviously use computers, but it's been a huge help with inventory control. As a matter of fact, we're going to a barcoding system first of the year. Both incoming and outgoing materials will all be barcoded.
And is that a significant cost investment for you, or is it just more of logistics and decision around that?
The initial investment will be somewhere around $30,000 or $40,000 for mm-hmm. the software package, but if you can increase your turns, you're a banker. You understand that,
right?
So, I mean, that's the goal, is to increase the turns.
All right. Both of you have just experienced incredible sales growth, and I know that business development is a passion of both of yours. How do you sustain an effective sales organization? Will, thoughts on that?
Well, the insurance industry is a sales and service, or the insurance brokerage industry, I think, is a sales and service business. You have to have a culture of sales. Do you develop a culture just by creating contests, by measuring, create, you have competitive people in your business. You show them each other's results. You know, you make them owners, and again, help them understand that new business and growth is the lifeblood of our business.
So you find the transparency amongst the team is really, really something that's beneficial to you.
Yeah, very, very much so. I would say that's right. Somebody said to me one time in our industry that was some great business advice I got. They said, "Nothing happens till somebody sells something." and a lot of people, you know, you can't pay people, you can't give 1% to your foundation, you can't do, you know, you can't have office space, you can't have a Christmas party until you have customers and right. revenues. And so, you know, I think we try to stay focused on that. And, you know, it's also, in our industry, you're either growing or shrinking. There's no status. There's no static.
Right.
You might think you're at a place where you need to be. You know, you build your book of business, you got a great lifestyle, but as soon as you stop focusing on new business, your income and your you know, your book of business starts to shrink.
Right. Matt, what about you?
I think you
can't grow 10x, you know, like you have without having that be a core of your business.
I think the biggest thing that I did back to when, you know, it goes back to my mom saying surround yourself with people smarter than you. It was about 5 or 6 years ago, I put together an advisory board, and I've got one of the gentlemen was president of a $2 billion company. He chooses to go unnamed. Another guy was president of a $400 million company. Of course, you know our CFO. He was CFO of a $200 million company. These are people on the advisory board. They have no fiduciary responsibility to the company other than to beat the living daylights out of me on a regular basis. We get together in person three times.
So that's true governance right there.
That's true governance.
Self-governance.
You know, 4 years ago, it was fun. We would get together for a few hours, and we'd play golf, and I'd beat them in golf. And then I think they upped the ante in the mornings, and, you know, now I can't break 100 in the afternoons. You know? But we get together, and we put together a book at the beginning of the year, and then we revisit the book during the year. We have a meeting in February, a meeting in June. And then we have a meeting/tax meeting in November. And then we have conference calls on a monthly basis. And I think it keeps me focused. I love to sell, but, you know, you got to run the business too.
Right. Okay. And, you know, you both talked about culture. You know, what's kind of one or two guiding principles that you really on a regular basis are trying to push down into your organizations, Will?
Yeah, you know, I think it's another overused term, but this this desire to have all your stakeholders win, mm-hmm. You know, is really a great business. It's just a great business model. I think we try to keep that think that builds our culture. We want our customers to win. We want our employees to win. Our vendors who are our insurance companies. I mean, you know, I think if everybody's happy doing business with you or working there, you just have a stronger culture. And you just have to continuously, it's just like sales. I mean, you have to continuously reinforce what your culture is through events and communication with your employees and just the way you live your life every day.
Mm-hmm. Great. Matt, guiding principles?
When, you know, from time to time, you know, we have, I guess we have 48 employees and about 6 temps for a total of 55, something like that. From time to time, employees get in trouble for whatever reason. Not necessarily trouble, but personal trouble. And our guiding principle is glue is insignificant. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've told that to our employees. Glue is insignificant. They look at me like I've lost my mind because that's what I preach the other 360 days a year. But
right.
Glue is insignificant. And it's important that it's a fair place to work and a fun place to work, and they all understand that we do give back to the community. So that's how we keep it fun.
Mm-hmm. Boy, what an incredible reminder for all of us that, you know, really any success in business comes from the team of the people that we put together. You both have an incredible team. Sometimes as you're growing, you need to hire new people. Talk a little bit about that, about how you go about finding the best partners. What have been some of your keys to success on that front? Will, thoughts on that?
Well, you know, the best people aren't looking for jobs.
Sure.
At least that's, you know, my philosophy. So I spend, as the, you know, leader of the firm, I spend 50% of my time as a goal. It doesn't always work that way, but my goal is to spend 50% of my time trying to recruit people to our firm. And a lot of that is just digging. It's just like, you know, sales of customers. I mean, you have to identify good people. You have to call them up and get them to go to breakfast with you. But we also do that with, you know, good service people as well. We're constantly looking for those people. If you wait for them to call you or if you wait for the headhunter to call you, I mean, typically you're just not going to get the same quality of person. So it's, again, being very proactive about people and, you know, looking for people that aren't looking for a job.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In my case, John, it's a little difficult because I like to say that we're the glue company's glue company. So we do a lot of business.
Wait, hang on. It's early in the morning, so help me understand what you mean there.
We do a lot of glue for other glue companies. So, yeah. Our warm market would be our customers' employees, and obviously that would be a problem.
Gotcha.
So, like Will, I'm always looking. Matter of fact, my executive assistant, and she also handles inside sales and our collections, she was customer service at a place that put my windshield in my Tahoe. Or not Tahoe, but the Sequoia. But I watched her on the phone with an irate customer, with an irate customer sitting in front of her, with me sitting down waiting on my Sequoia to get fixed. And she handled them all very capably.
As we know, you can be an irate customer, too.
I was not irate.
You were getting there.
I was getting there. I gave her my card and said, if you're ever looking for a good job, we're always looking for good people.
How about that?
I bet we've picked up 10 or 15 people with that. We're always looking for good people. It doesn't happen immediately. Sometimes people get frustrated. But just like Will said, it's a big part of my job as the leader to bring on good people.
Yeah, you've both shared some great tips and business advice, but I always like to ask, what's the best advice you got? And you've already said it with the revenue and the surround yourself with good people, but any other thoughts on that, Will?
You know, the funny thing is when you gave me a little advance notice on that question, and I thought about the one I said earlier, what nothing happens till somebody sells something. And the other one I wrote down was very similar to what Matt said, and that was that you surround yourself with great people, you empower them, you align your interests with them, and you you give away the business to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think is the best advice I've ever gotten.
Great. Thanks.
Best advice I ever received was from a gentleman by the name of Bill Doris, and he's 17 years older to the day older than me. We've shared the same birthday, obviously, our whole lives. But he talked about integrity when I joined the company in 1983, which is obviously a long time ago. And I was in his office, and he said, the one thing, he said, you can do a lot, but if you ever lose your integrity, you're done.
Right.
And in the lumber business where I came out of before I joined my dad's company, most of that business is done on a handshake or a phone call with a PO. Hey, it's John Coffin, or it's Matt Devine, or it's Will. And that's good enough to place an order for millions of dollars. If you ever lose your integrity, you've lost everything. So that was the best advice. Besides my mom's advice of surround yourself with smart people.
Right.
That would be the best.
Has your mom kind of continued to be an advisor to you over the years?
Anytime I call her. Matter of fact, on Sunday, talking about the new facility, she's like, I don't think you should do that. And I said, well, you don't get a vote anymore. Just teasing.
No, mom always gets a vote.
Mom always gets a vote.
Or always gets advised, I guess. That's great. Okay, fantastic. Thank you, guys. We're gonna move into the speed round. I gave you a little bit of a preview, but I'm going to throw you a couple curveballs here.
Okay.
So, Will, what'd you want to be when you were growing up?
A baseball player.
Okay. And if you were to, say you had become a baseball player, what position would you want to play and on what team?
I would probably be a pitcher since I'm a lefty.
Okay.
And lefties have a distinct advantage. You don't have to be nearly as talented to be a lefty and play baseball.
So I'm not a huge baseball aficionado. So why is it that a lefty pitcher has such an advantage? I've never really understood that.
The ball coming to the plate just tails away from hitters.
Okay.
And they just can't hit it as easily.
So it's a movement thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
It's not how it comes off your hand or anything.
Well, that could be some of it too.
Like
I think
that.
It comes from a different place and they're not quite as used to seeing it. So.
Okay. All right. So a pitcher with what
probably.
Team?
My favorite team's the Boston Red Sox. I know that's a controversial pick here in Atlanta, but I grew up in North Carolina and grew up as a Red Sox fan before they, when the curse of the Babe was still intact.
Okay.
So I'm not a new fan.
So this is a longstanding commitment.
Yes, it is.
All right. Oh,
yes, it is.
Matt, what about you? When you were growing up, what did you want to be?
It was simple. I was short, so I couldn't play basketball. So I wanted to be a millionaire. I know that sounds crazy, but I used to. Yeah, we grew up poor. I mean, you know, my dad was making very little money in Charlotte, North Carolina. You know, the paper route was, you know, I needed the paper route because I needed money. So I wanted to be a millionaire.
Yeah.
But if you were to relate it to sports, I'd want to be a point guard on Notre Dame's basketball team.
There you go.
There you go.
All right. Well, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I had a lot of dirty jobs growing up. You know, you mentioned paperboy. How important was that to you, just getting that work ethic as a young kid?
It was incredible. And what you learn, my dad had a paper route. My dad put himself through college, you know, at Drexel University, doing a paper route in the morning, working in the bank, and then going to school at night. And he ended up at DuPont and then ultimately on his own business. Paper route is great. You don't have them anymore. People aren't even reading the newspapers.
Right.
I mean, I was about 5 foot, you know, kind of back to the Rudy movie, 5 foot nothing, 170 pounds of nothing, and I had this 90 newspapers I had to deliver. I could barely even drive the bike. But I did it every day.
All the neighbors are like, here comes Matt. Stop the car so we don't know what's going to happen. There we go. Well, you guys have both mentioned your favorite charity, so I typically ask that just because we really like to go out on the wire with great charities. But what about downtime? How do you like to spend your downtime, Will?
You know, I spent a lot of time with my family. I have three kids, a daughter, 21. She's a University of Georgia student, and a son that's a senior in high school and a seventh grader. I've spent about the last 10 years coaching baseball teams for those boys. That's been a big part of my life. My other passion outside my family is saltwater fly fishing, though. That's probably my number one love.
Now, where do you go for that? I mean, I'm sure you
well,
go
well, one of the advantages
places,
you have but... to go. You typically have to go where it's beautiful and tropical, and there's you know you have to be able to see in the water because it's all sight fishing. So you're in shallow water, and you have to go to really beautiful places like the Bahamas and the Florida Keys to do that.
Sounds good. Sign me up. What about you, Matt? Downtown?
Really spend time with the family. Mm-hmm. I've traveled for a living my whole life. So weekends are for the family. I do enjoy golf when I get a chance to play it, but it's not that important.
Yeah.
I do coach basketball or have for years. Both my boys are in middle school basketball, so I'm not coaching anymore. But, that, you know, downtime is kind of, you know, working around the house and figuring out what's next week.
What's your favorite golf course that you've ever played?
Two of them, probably. First would be Augusta, but I haven't played it, so that was... But Piedmont Driving Course, which you and I were fortunate enough to play, and then I like Sage Valley down in Graniteville, South Carolina.
Okay, mm-hmm. Great. That's fantastic. Well, guys, one other thing. You know, resources for growth are always just critical for CEOs, and sometimes great ideas can come from different places. Tell me a book or a movie or, you know, a speech that you recently heard that you thought was particularly – where you kind of said, I might kind of incorporate a couple of those ideas into something. Will?
You know, I have to give a shout-out to my friend Tommy Newberry, who's a local author, sort of a life coach type guy, and he wrote a book called Success is Not an Accident, which is not something recently that I've read, but I think it's very impactful, and it's a great book about getting your life into sort of a goal-oriented place, and then making some very specific steps and how to achieve those goals.
Fantastic, thank you, Matt.
I can't really mention a book. I read 4 to 5 books a month, but I can mention people. Anytime Richard Branson is around. I don't agree with a lot of them on some social issues, but as an entrepreneur, he's probably one of the best ever in the history of the world. Jack Welch, I've read all his books. Pretty incredible.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, CNBC, if you watch it on a regular basis in the morning, early, they're bringing guests on that talk about top line and CapEx and operating expenses, and this is what flows to the bottom line. So you learn a lot, believe it or not, from CNBC, and I do a lot of that.
Yeah, that's great. Well, fantastic. I really appreciate you guys coming into the studio today. This has just been a wealth of information for our listeners, and I thank you for your time. Tell us, if you would, Will, how folks can learn about in Ironwood and get in contact with you.
Well, we have a great website. It's www.ironwoodins.com. We have a person at our office named Dallas Nevins, who is dedicated to social media for us. So I don't know anything about it, but she does a great job of putting us out there on LinkedIn and Facebook and all these things that are strange words for me. But I think we have
you're social in different ways, though, right?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Okay. Fantastic. Thank you, Matt.
We have a website, dhmadhesives.com, or they can, call me personally at 1-800-745-1346.
Fantastic. Well, thank you both.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Join us again next week for another Founders Club broadcast, sponsored by Atlantic Capital Bank and powered by Business Radio X.